name is Cheryl Kronowski, and I'm a research coordinator at St. Louis University and also a public health master's student there. Today I'm going to be talking about defining a physical activity policy and environmental research agenda, obtaining the perspectives of practitioners and researchers. Before I get started, I'd like to acknowledge the principal investigators on this study, Ross Brunson, Cheryl Kelly, and Amy Eiler at St. Louis University, and then Tom Schmidt from the CDC. I'd also like to acknowledge some of the collaborators on this project who have contributed a lot of important input on it. So despite the known health benefits of physical activity, only 1 in 4 Americans engage in little or no regular physical activity, and this can lead to numerous health problems such as diabetes, heart disease, and such things like that. Possible solutions to increasing physical activity have focused primarily on individual-level interventions, and these are unlikely to affect activity patterns and trends that impact the majority of the population. A more promising strategy lies in environmental and policy approaches, because these are more likely to impact a greater proportion of the population and also to lead to long-term changes. So it's pretty well known that practitioners want to consistently have a higher level of influence over the production of research. And unfortunately, research agendas are generally put together by either funding agencies or by individual research teams. And they don't take into account what practitioners and researchers from across the country think would be important to research. This lack of input can lead to gaps in the knowledge base and can result in the funding of low-priority research. Therefore, in this project, our primary objectives were to obtain input from practitioners and researchers on an agenda for environmental and policy research, and then to prioritize this input into a concise research agenda. So even though there is a growing body of research on physical activity in the physical environment, the evidence base for many policy interventions is sparse and the conceptual issues are underdeveloped. In this project, we sought to utilize a systematic process, input from hundreds of individuals, rigorous methodology, and then we also hope that this is a springboard for future research and improved practice in physical activity promotion. So the methods that we used was to use concept mapping. This is a technique that obtains and organizes input from many practitioners or from many perspectives and disciplines, builds consensus among disparate groups, so it's pretty well known that researchers and practitioners tend to not always agree, so this method helps to sort of combine and build a consensus. It also helps to build knowledge, provides details in an organized and unique framework of action, and then provides a basis for prioritizing these actions. So this slide presents an overview of concept mapping. It includes 6 steps. The first step is to just prepare the project. This is when the participants are selected, and then the primary question or the focus of the project is determined. Next, ideas are generated through group brainstorming, and then those ideas are then structured through a sorting and rating process. Then those sorted and rated ideas are put into the concept system software, where it computes the maps, and then they interpret the maps, and then the maps are finally utilized. And I will be describing each of these steps in more detail as they relate to our particular project of developing the research agenda. Now, the first step, preparation, is when the planning group defines the issue to be addressed. In this project, a core group of 10 researchers and practitioners define the focus statement. The focus statement here was one research topic that will best inform policy or environmental approaches to physical activity promotion is. And this statement was intentionally left open-ended because it allows the participants to then finish the statement with their own personal ideas when they're doing the group brainstorming. Next, the core group initially identified and nominated 641 people from a variety of disciplines to participate. And these 641 people represented both researchers and practitioners from across the U.S. And some of the examples of the practitioners that participated in this process were physical activity coordinators, urban planners, safe routes to school coordinators, and public health consultants. And then of the 641 that were nominated, 600 were actually invited to brainstorm. And this whole process was done online and through email for the invitation. And so the reason that there's less is because we may have had invalid emails or incorrect addresses for these people. So of those that were invited, 239 actually responded to the email, went onto the site, and brainstormed. These 238 individuals generated over 600 statements in response to the focus prompt, which again I have at the bottom of the screen, was one research topic that will best inform policy or environmental approaches to physical activity promotion is. So those 238 people were able to finish the statement, and they came up with 600 ideas. But using a systematic process involving four different coders, we were able to reduce the number of statements down to 109. And this was an important step because if you remember in the first graph that I showed you with the overview of the concept mapping, the next step is going to be to rate and sort the ideas. So you can imagine what a daunting task that would be to have to rate and sort 600 ideas. And getting them down to 109 is still a difficult task, but at least it's a little bit more manageable. So one of the ways the statements were reduced was to edit the list for relevance and representativeness and to eliminate any redundancy in the statements. For example, the effect of crime was a frequent statement that was brought up during brainstorming, and we were able to take those statements that were basically the same thing and condense them into one statement or idea that would represent the other ones. So as I mentioned, the next step is to take these 109 ideas and sort and rate them. For the rating portion, the same group of participants who brainstormed were then asked to rate each of the 109 statements of the condensed list that we came up with on their importance and feasibility, which I'll go into more detail about each of these. But a smaller group of participants, after they were rated, was selected from the same pool of individuals, and they were based on their expertise in the field of physical activity, and they were asked to individually sort or group the research ideas into themes or categories based on the similarity of ideas. So for that larger group that had first brainstormed and then they were invited back to rate the statements, they were given access to two surveys. The first survey was asked each person to rate each idea on its importance relative to other topics. The second survey rated the feasibility of implementing the idea within the next 5 years. Oops, did I go too far? The scores ranged from 0, equaling relatively unimportant to or not feasible, to 10, equaling highly important or extremely feasible. So of the 600 people, of the people that were invited to rate the statements, the people that brainstormed and then rated, 107 actually completed this portion of the process, or about 18%, and they contributed their input on the importance rating, where about 88 people, or 15%, contributed their input on the feasibility ratings. And then that smaller group that I told you about that was asked to rate the statements, or sort them, I'm sorry, they were asked to sort the statements, 20 people actually participated, or about 80%. So among the 107 people who rated the statements for importance and feasibility, 58% were researchers and 42% were practitioners. So there was a fairly equal distribution among the two. The majority worked in health promotion, and the other portion worked in related disciplines such as transportation and urban planning. Data from the sorted and rated ideas were then entered into the concept system software to compute the maps. This software takes the data and performs cluster analysis and multidimensional scaling to allow for visual representation of the data in the form of clusters. To compute the maps, first the software uses the multidimensional scaling to place those 109 statements in relation to each other on XY coordinates. Conceptually similar ideas that were frequently sorted together were mapped in close proximity. So for example, on the right, both the statements refer to low-income communities, and they appear closer together because they were repeatedly sorted together by the participants. In comparison, the statement on the bottom left refers to understanding the role of selection bias. and this was not frequently sorted with the other two statements and therefore is not placed in close proximity. In addition, it's just important to note that these numbers do not denote importance. They're simply just an ID number for all the different statements, so 1 is not better than 10, or vice versa. Next, hierarchical clustering analysis was used to create clusters of statements that presumably reflect similar concepts, again using the concept system software. A smaller cluster here suggests that there is more agreement among the people that rated the statements, and the distance between the clusters suggests conceptual similarity with, so for those with greater distances suggests that there's less conceptual similarity between the clusters. The final concept map presents an arrangement of these clusters of ideas. Each cluster was then named by the core group based on the set of ideas within the cluster. So the core group of those 10 researchers that started off that decided on the people that would participate and came up with a focus statement then looked at these statements and determined, and the clusters, and determined what the actual cluster should be named. So you can see some of the ones that are closer together and are more condensed are the city planning and design, implementation of policies, schools and communities. So the next step is to interpret what these colorful clusters actually mean. And as you can see, this is often the most difficult task. Now this graph helps to form the basis of the research agenda and actually looks at the rating. So those clusters were what showed actually what was the sort, how the data was sorted, but this looks at the actual rating of the data. And it was created using a scale from 1 to 10. So if you remember, everyone had to rate their importance and the feasibility from 1 to 10. So this one shows the importance. And it plots the average rating of the statements for each cluster. Based on the item ratings of both researchers and practitioners, the cluster on city planning and design emerged as the most important, followed by economic evaluation. So you can see at the top, the researchers are on the left and the practitioners are on the right. And the highest one that was actually rated was city planning and design as being the most important for future research. And you can see that there is a high overall concordance between the researchers and practitioners on the importance of the statements with at the bottom. I don't know if everyone can see it, but there's a correlation of 0.86. For feasibility, both researchers and practitioners assign the highest rating to items in the schools cluster. The next most feasible cluster was population subgroups among researchers and measurement methodology among the practitioners. As with the importance ratings, there was also a high agreement between the two types with a correlation of 0.77. Now this third figure essentially is a combination of the last two graphs that I just showed you. It compares the ratings for importance among practitioners on the left and then the ratings for feasibility among researchers on the right. Now the rationale for this analysis was that practitioners are more likely to be closer to what is needed in communities they serve, so they may know what's more important for the communities, while researchers are closer to the research process and they may know that doing a certain type of research study may not be at all feasible. And then these analyses showed an inverse correlation with a correlation of negative 0.59. So essentially what practitioners thought was extremely important, the researchers thought it was going to be not feasible at all, and vice versa. The last step is to utilize the maps. 26 individuals, 20 of whom had participated in the sorting of the research, met for an in-person meeting in February of this year to go over the concept maps and to discuss how they would be utilized. After initial discussion of the results and potential products, the participants were divided into 5 work groups. And then each of those work groups was assigned 1 or 2 clusters, with the different themed shapes that you saw earlier, those clusters. Each of those groups was given a couple of clusters, and then they were asked to get together and discuss 3 main questions. What are some tools or methods that would be useful in studying each issue? How might various disciplines and professions work together to address these research areas? And what actions need to be taken to move this research agenda forward as quickly as possible, and by whom? The meeting resulted in the following recommendations to utilize the research agenda. There needs to be more specific surveillance tools. These tools, along with results, should be geared toward a broader audience. There's a need for evaluation of natural experiments. Future research should include components that are qualitative and participatory, and there needs to be improved communication among disciplines to reduce duplication of research. So implementation of this research agenda will require coordination and strategic planning, long-term commitment from funders, and recognition of the top research priorities. Also, this agenda provides a springboard for action for future research in physical activity and environmental research. And then all researchers who are interested in actually utilizing this agenda will soon be able to access it in the Journal of Physical Activity and Health. And this is, the paper is currently in press. It's not out yet. And then also, the Physical Activity Policy Research Network at St. Louis University has been able to get continued funding based on the fact that they're using the research agenda to develop their top research priorities for their network. So it's already being used. So in conclusion, we hope that this agenda continues to serve as a catalyst to promote future research in the top priority areas seen by both researchers and practitioners across the country. We hope that this research will in turn lead to greater long-term population-wide change in physical activity levels. Finally, I'd like to acknowledge the following organizations who contributed vastly to this project.
That's the last of our presentations. We have a few minutes for discussion. If people have questions, if you could tell me who you'd like to ask the question to and state your name, and I'll repeat it, and then they can respond. Yes. Okay. The question was, what's the reasoning behind doing voluntary HIAs?
You know, honestly, when you go to, there's a lot of the more progressive places are the ones who are interested in it. For instance, our Atlanta Regional Commission is interested in looking at our Livable Centers Initiative and redesigning corridors, because they've already kind of got health on the radar screen, but they don't quite know how to measure it. And when we've had funding to select places, for instance, Stapleton Airport, when they were redeveloping that into the live, work, play community, it's kind of the people who already kind of have it on their radar screen, but just don't quite know how to measure it. It's typically some of the voluntary ones. Other times we've just done them because we think it's an important issue. And for some of the walk to school ones in the Buford Highway, it was just such a giant problem that, you know, we ended up selecting. And I'm trying to, so it's, there's a coal plant in Florida, and they actually paid some consultants to do it because there was so much opposition from the community, and they really wanted to detail, was there really going to be huge impacts in the community's health? So it's really for a variety of reasons. It's hard to really give a summary of all the different ones that have been done across places. In San Francisco, voluntarily, they just assumed it as part of their job. Looking at a lot of times it's like they're tearing down low-income housing and replacing it with very high-income housing, displacing all of the people. So Rajiv and his group have gone in and said, you need to, find some housing or, save a certain number of these units for the low-income population. So it's not always the developers asking. Sometimes it's a public health professional. You just see the need to have it done. And in other instances, it actually is the developers or the transportation people coming to us and asking for the analysis. So it's done, I'd probably say, for those two primarily reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure Aaron, and I think he's here in the audience, can he's in the back. He's the one who's doing a lot of the work up in Alaska with the oil and the coal mines. And, you know, and that's one thing that you realize, I mean, everyone who's involved in the process, and ideally you have a stakeholder group, and that's what you define in scoping, where you get everyone who's going to be coming from all of the different perspectives. And sometimes it does get very contentious. With the Buford Highway one, you know, we had different reactions from different groups. Some people thought it was great that we were looking at this, and other times it can get, you know, not so friendly. So there's actually a great book by Kemm, K-E-M-M, and where they've detailed all of the different countries' experiences with this. And there's always going to be different people with different agendas. And you just kind of have to, as a practitioner, it's like you just kind of have to be aware of where everyone's coming from. And you need to maintain your scientific objective when you're doing the HIA. And I didn't actually list the values of an HIA. It's democracy and equity, you know, scientific robust practice, you know, sustainable development. So you do have values that underpin these HIAs. Absolutely. Ideally, the community is involved in all steps of the process. And Rajiv has done, if you read the Oak Tonight and some of the other ones they've done, he is really the leader in community involvement. And everything from, you know, looking up the research question to prioritizing recommendations to even help formulating recommendations. So it's absolutely appropriate to have them involved in the scoping process.
One more HIA question, then Candace will be at this back door for and I believe you're in the center.
Actually, gentrification was a huge issue in the Beltline redevelopment that Catherine Ross talked about yesterday. And there are several things you can do. You know, for instance, and some of the recommendations in that was when they were building new housing units, save a certain number of those units for, you know, low-income residents. Fixing the tax, you know, so it's set so it's like when you put the park in, you're not going to see huge increases in housing prices. Rajiv's done a lot of work where, you know, when they do the redevelopment, you save a certain number of houses for gentrification. Some measures you can look at increases in taxes. You can look at increases in housing values. Unfortunately, the census is, you know, somewhat outdated. It only comes up every 10 years or might be, you know, more local things. But it's a huge issue when you're looking at urban redevelopments, especially in Atlanta with Buford Highway. I mean, it's Atlanta's gentrifying. A lot of big cities are as people are moving out from the suburbs back into the city, and you're starting to even see the, you know, inner ring suburban decay, you know, as they're building, I mean, all of these high-end developments in the city. So it really is. And I would recommend going to the Beltline report online. It's available at the Center for Quality Growth and Regional Development. We actually did a really good job going through that section. Absolutely. Yeah.
Last question.
This is not an HIA question. It's for Dr. Gomez.
Okay. And Candace will be in the back door.
and that is whether some of these same considerations relating to physical activity, the built environment, whether you look at these or other parts of the Colombian government are looking at these in more rural areas, not so much in the urban areas.
Excuse me, could you help me? Excuse me, my English is... Could you... No, we haven't made studies in rural areas. To our knowledge, this is the first study in built environment and physical activity, and was made in the urban area of Bogota. but we are very interested in carrying out other studies in other contexts, in other urban forms, not only in Colombia but in Latin America. Perhaps the weather, the topographic characteristics, we could obtain other results.
Second row. white.
There's the Network of Ciclovia of the Americas. It was created 2 years ago in Bogota. And in the U.S., part of that network is Chicago. They have a place of, I think it's just about 3 kilometers. It's small, but it's something. And there's another one that I recently read about that's in El Paso, in Texas. However, just remember that Bogota is a city where only 20% of the households have cars. So we have 80% of the household with cars. So sometimes there are actually problems with the rich people who have cars, and they have problems on Sundays when they want to get out. And actually, 2 weeks ago, there was a politician who wants to reduce the time of the ciclovía. So we have to come up with all the results and show how good it is for quality of life before they reduce that. But again, it's only 20%, and it's something, and it's a program that has been for more than 20 years, actually 30 years, since the 1970s. So the ciclovía is actually part of our lives. So to answer your question, it seems that it's an initiative that it's becoming more popular in other countries. Like there's another ciclovía in Mexico, there's one in Perth in Australia, there's some in Guatemala, but there are more in the developing world. I think it's because it's not as a problem because of the car-dependent societies.
It's very important to bear in mind, the proportion of families that own cars. Bogota is a pedestrian city. The compactness of the city, and we respect other cities of developed countries, the green areas per inhabitant is low, is relatively low. It's only 4 meters square per inhabitant.
The term transportation, it's not only activities of daily living, but that's what they looked at.
The proportion of the prevalence of adults in Bogota who meet the physical activity recommendation is approximately 44%. The walking levels, I don't remember in this moment, people who meet the recommendations walking for transport is approximately, I don't remember in this moment, 15%. Yes, biking as a means of transport is approximately 3.3%. It's relatively low, but the leisure time physical activity is very low. Only the 8% of the population in Bogota meet the leisure time physical activity. And it's very important take into account, the motivations of leisure time physical activity is quite different to utilitarian purposes. Because I don't know, but perhaps an important proportion of pedestrians in Bogota not select the walking because they don't have other option. They don't have other option. The distance to public transport perhaps is very long, and or they are very poor, and they have only money to pay a ticket.
The results reinforced our understanding that what controls leisure behavior is different than what controls transport-related behavior.
Perhaps Olga Lucia, that have studied that issue about the gender differences, that is very remarkable in our study. And all the studies of physical activity that we have conducted in Colombia and in Bogota, it's very remarkable.
We definitely want to understand a little bit the gender differences. We see that the only behavior that's more prevalent among women is walking for transport, and sometimes, and we have in some of our studies, and it's a group that is not as big. It's only like 5% of women who walk actually more than 60 minutes per day. And I think that's an indicator of poverty. And that's the only behavior related with physical activity that's more prevalent among women. But other behaviors like walking for leisure time or meeting CDC recommendations of physical activity during leisure time or even participating in the Ciclovia the prevalence is lower for women. However, there's one program that is not as old as the Ciclovia, that it's called Recreovia, and what that program is that during the Sundays there are 26 points for aerobics around the parks that the Ciclovia has. In those parks there are programs for aerobics, yoga, Pilates, a lot of physical activity activities, and that's the only program for which women are participate more. So we think that probably having other type of programs such as aerobics for women or activities just for women will be more important than biking or than other activities just participating in the Ciclovia.
Very briefly, is behind these gender disparities, there should be structural factors. As for example, I don't remember the figure, but the proportion of family with a single parent, only the mother and the children, is very important. We should bear in mind the violence processes in Latin America, and I think there are other structural factors that may explain that, the caregiving responsibilities of a lot of mothers in Latin America.
Last question.
Briefly, Colombia is a very complex country with a lot of contrasts. If you visit Bogota, I invite you to visit Bogota. For example, Bogota is more secure than Sao Paulo, than Rio de Janeiro, with a lot of cities of Latin America. Other regions are more dangerous with high rates of kidnapping. The security conditions in Bogota, I think, have improved in a significant way. Unfortunately, the kidnappings are relatively rare in this moment. I don't know if other members, but in rural areas, in some rural areas, the guerrilla movements, paramilitaries, and other groups, evidently, the presence are remarkable, but Bogota is is more safer than Mexico DF, for example.
Just a final note on that. it does influence design, and it influences design in terms of, you notice the spectrum of households that they did the study in, they weren't able to gain access to the richest part of society, partially because they have such security. So it has influenced design in that way to some degree. If people have further questions, we'll be at this back door out here.